And on the telephone right now is our Winder Core, who wrote this fascinating book, award-winning book, Living Well Human. Hi, Arwinder.
Hey there. How you doing?
I'm doing great. And you might be interested in the last conversation that the one we just had on the radio. I was speaking with legendary actress Ruta Lee, one of her best friends, Lucille Ball. And I relayed the story that you told in the book, that all of you were, Jesse, you walk into a room, you're in India, it was some number of years ago, and everyone is laughing hysterically at what? I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
And they didn't even, they didn't understand English, but that did not matter, did it?
No. It was just a fascination with moving images. They'd never seen it. It was the only place in the local area where anybody had a TV. And this was in the early 70s. So, yeah, they were just absolutely fascinated.
But that's not what the book is about. The book is partially about you and your story, but the book is also about all of us and the planet that we live on. What motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, it was a bit of an unusual process. I didn't have like a full manuscript that I submitted. I actually just was focusing on the very last part of the book, which is called The Compass. And that's the only part I was going to actually publish. That's basically a kind of a template. It's a compass on how to live as humans on this planet. Basically philosophical sort of principles and sayings and maxims. And when I went to publish that, then the editor suggested, well, since no one knew me, that it might be a good idea to put in a little bit about myself, you know, just to talk about myself a little bit. So then I started the process at when we came to Canada from India. And then she said, oh, that's really great. This adds a lot more. It's excellent. But how about we start from how you got to Canada? So it just kept building. It was more of a manuscript, in progress, not really finished. But you know what? I'm glad I listened to her because I think it worked really well, because what it does is it helps lay a foundation in terms of my early experiences traveling around the world as a teenager and all of the life lessons that I've learned. And then how I was able to kind of use that foundation in terms of my activism in terms of social justice, animal welfare, and ultimately the ecology. And probably the real springboard for the actual book in terms of the ecological part of it, I would have to credit Daniel Quinn and his book Ishmael that I read that basically changed my life and projected me, propelled me into this whole world of eco sort of sensitivities. And obviously that includes every living species on the planet.
Now, no offense, you're not a TV star. You aren't, you are not a multi-published, but to the best of my knowledge, not a multi-published author. So are you surprised that out of the box, you win all of these awards for best book?
Yeah, I kind of actually was shocked. The first one I won, I was like, wow, this is amazing, you know? And then I thought, well, that was going to be, my one-off, And then and the more I entered, the more I kept winning. And I thought, well, I must be really resonating with people, because there's something here that people are obviously really, really connecting to and responding to. And maybe it's the timeliness of it, but also I think what I've heard from people is the authentic, sort of nature of it and the passion. And I guess who I am really sort of comes through. And I think that there's also some new perspectives in there probably that maybe perhaps other people hadn't really thought about. So definitely, I'm very surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised. I don't know if you got to that one part in the book. There is a photo in there, because I know you're a dog lover, an animal lover, actually. And there's a picture I have in there of one of my dogs that I have right now, who detected cancer in one of my mentors, who just passed away a couple of years ago. But he detected cancer in him twice, and he's never even been trained to do that. So, yeah, sometimes some surprising things can happen in our lives, and we just say, wow, that's really cool.
Well, it's not a, I didn't know about the cancer part, of course. So,
yeah,
but you mentioned it, so I want you to tell me that story. Yeah. What happened?
Oh, yeah. Well, my elderly friend, you know, I mentioned him in my book. I've known him since I was 10 years old. And he'd been visiting. I had my dog about 8 years by then. And he was a regular visitor. And nothing unusual ever happened. And this one particular time when he had come to visit, my dog just would not stop licking him, his head particularly. Hmm. And the whole time he was visiting with me, it would have been about 3 hours, he just licked him nonstop, even though I'd try to keep pushing him away. And we were just sort of laughing, saying, "Gee, oh, he must like my salty head or something," you know. We just laughed it off. We didn't think anything of it.
Uh-huh.
But I just thought, that was a bit unusual. So unbeknownst to me, my friend had actually been feeling a bit of a strange sensation on the top of his head. And he thought, well, maybe I'll go in and get that checked out. And as soon as he went in, they said, "Oh, my God, you got melanoma. You have to go in immediately and have surgery and have that removed." And next time I saw him, he had literally, like, you know, part of his skull was missing, and he had ointment and a bandage. And I thought, what happened? He says, "Oh, well, you know, melanoma." And so I didn't think anything of it again. He said, but they've assured me they got it all, so I'm good to go. So then a number of months later, he came to visit again. And my dog, Monty, was doing the same thing, alerting, basically. And he kept licking him again the whole time he was visiting. He was licking, licking, wouldn't stop. So by then, my friend had actually started believing that maybe, you know, because he's a believer of these things as well, that they do. I mean, it's scientifically proven. So he went back, and the doctor said, "No, we have to take you right back in. We didn't get it all." So, so he went in for another procedure, and then we realized that Monty's actually alerting. This is just unbelievable, and he's never been trained, and I wouldn't have even known had I not, you know, we put these things together. And then after that, it became a bit of a joke. I said, he's like an oncologist. You know, we're making house calls, and my friend Tony would tell me, "Look, you better bring Monty around. I think I need another checkup," you know, and I would go there, and he had no interest in his head. I would try to push him towards his head, and he was, like, pushing back, like, "Why are you forcing me to look at his head?" He had no interest in his head because it was all gone then.
Yeah.
And he did it to a dog once, too.
Really?
My friend's dog. My dog was visiting, and this was even before the thing with Tony. And he was visiting, and he knew these people really well. We'd stayed there, looked after their dog. They had a Labradoodle. And they were very close. And my friend phoned me and said, "You better come and pick your dog up because I don't know what's wrong with him, but he is just howling, just god-awful howls. We can't take it. It sounds horrible." And I didn't know what was going on with him, and neither did they. I said, "Well, I have no idea what's going on with him. This is very bizarre." And a week later, their dog passed away, and they didn't even know that he'd had a cancer.
You know, I have a doctor's appointment next Tuesday. I'm canceling that. I'm coming to your house, Arwinder.
I know.
Well, this is not what the book is about. We will talk about what the book is about and why it resonates so much with so many people and what you say about all of us, how we are all committing our own suicide. And we will talk about that when we come back. The name of the book, Living Well Human. Colin, you couldn't have chosen a better song there. To bump us back in, we're talking to Arwinder Kaur, the author of Living Well Human. And you say in the book, Arwinder, and I'm quoting pretty much here, "The mutant culture devours every item and species on the planet. No other species is taking or consuming anything we require to survive." So that kind of gets into the core of what you write about here in this book.
Right. Well, basically, again, we have to look at, and I talk about this in my book, needs versus wants. Obviously, we have confused the two greatly. But if you really look at it from a biological point of view of us being another species on this planet like all others, we actually need the same thing every other species on this planet needs, and that's clean air, clean water, viable soil, a secure place to live, and the ability to, have offspring for the survival of the species. So we actually need the same things. But the other species, for billions of years, have basically been following a law that only humans don't seem to understand. And there is a law that all other species follow. And that's why the Earth has been totally balanced. And it's been pristine. Like, if you look at the water, the air, everything has been absolutely clean. Everything that it comes from nature goes back to nature. There's really no such thing as waste in the natural world, because whatever waste is for one species, it may be a food source for another. So everything has been absolutely balanced. And the other thing that no other species ever does is outstrip its resources. And so they always maintain a balance between the population and what the resources are that can sustain that population. So it's kind of not a coincidence when you think about it that all the other species are just going about their own business, not polluting, not hoarding, not destroying, and in fact, keeping it viable so that the rest of us, humans, can actually continue to live, because we are actually dependent on the ecology to survive. And it's the other species that are actually keeping our ecology healthy and viable. So that is the difference, because we haven't figured out that what we need is the same as other species. And so we need to protect those very same things. Because a lot of people say, well, if I want to have, this is a want now, if I want to have fish 24/7, 365, I demand that, and I should be able to eat it. And if that means that the seals go extinct because they starve, so be it. And this is how we treat every single species on the planet, to the point now where it's, you know, become a crisis, where our ecology, which I sort of refer to as our immune system of the planet, has become so degraded that it's really on the cusp now of total implosion, which is what we're seeing now with all of the fires and floods and hurricanes, and at a rate that we have not seen before. So nature is kind of struggling to kind of find that balance that has existed for billions of years. And we haven't figured out that we can't just keep taking everything we want. So yes, somebody might want fish, but the thing is, we're very fortunate. We're omnivores, which means we can eat anything on the planet. So our ability to survive is very vast, very broad. We're the most adaptable species. But a seal doesn't eat anything else. The only thing a seal can eat is fish. So if that means that we need to say, hey, you know what, there's not enough fish right now, we need to not eat fish for a while until the seal population can become rebalanced, we could do that very easily. But we don't, because we've mixed up our whole concept of what is it that we need and what is it that we want.
Well, a
and
couple
that kind of led to, yeah.
A couple ahead. Of questions based on even what you just said. One mm-hmm. is, I can hear now half of the listeners saying, oh man, she's right. I'm really worried about the environment, et cetera, et cetera. However, I can hear mm-hmm. the other half saying, there they go again, talking about the same old thing. You know, this really isn't a concern of mine. They're not thinking mm-hmm. about their kids. They're not thinking about their grandkids. Mm-hmm. And they don't even believe that what you are saying is true in the first place. How can the disappearance of, say, white rhinos mm-hmm. or orangutans affect me?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, it's just like I've said, it's not any one species that's going to destroy us. The problem is it's the massive number of them in a short amount of time. And what's happening is every time we destroy, for example, the Amazon forest, which we're cutting down to, you know, allow for raising of cattle and all of that sort of thing, well, it's not a matter of believing. I mean, it's like saying, well, I don't believe in gravity, so I'm just going to jump off this, you know, this tall building. It doesn't matter. You don't have to believe in it, but you are going to fall down and die and kill yourself because you don't believe in gravity. So it doesn't make it untrue. And that is the same as if we understand that the lungs of our planet. What do we breathe in? We need air. Like, if you don't have any air to your, you know, your brain, within a few minutes, you can be brain dead and die. Literally, like, that's how long we can go without having oxygen. The trees and the plants are what produce oxygen. So you don't have to believe that you need rhinos, or you don't have to believe that you need all of these things, but you do need to believe that we need air. So where does air come from? We don't produce air. Air is produced by our ecological system. And that's the problem when people are not looking at this in the sense that everything is connected. And you know, if you're not looking around and putting two and two together, then that's a problem. And not believing in something doesn't make it untrue. It just makes it that you're not informed and you're not preparing yourself. And if you love children and love your children and their children, then you have a responsibility to fully educate yourself and inform yourself to what the facts are so that you can prepare for them, right? It's like we get insurance. We don't want to have a car accident, but we get insurance because just in case it happens, we want to be able to be prepared for it. So this is sort of a similar sort of thing. We need to prepare for what's happening.
However, this has become a political issue. And I don't want to talk about politics per se, but it has. Yeah. And not only in America, in some other countries as well. In other countries, they look at us like we're how could this be politics? It's about what's happening in the world and the animals that are being threatened, our oceans that are being threatened. Don't care about Republicans. Don't care about Democrats. But nevertheless, it has become a political issue.
Well, these things have been hijacked. And when we say political, actually, we can replace that word political with financial, because that's ultimately what it comes down to. It comes down to, you know, big corporations that are largely responsible for much of the, you know, the massive amounts of, like, for example, toxic waste and a lot of the climate change that's happening, because they produce things at such a big, you know, massive scale. So it's a financial issue more than a political issue, but nobody puts it that way. But that's what it comes down to. It's big dollars versus, you know, the community that's saying, hey, we're in trouble. But what that would mean then is for, you know, industry to have to make a lot of changes and change the way they do things. And perhaps they're too worried about their profit margins to say, well, we don't care, you know, about what it is that we're supposed to be doing or needing to do, as long as we can carry on and do what we're doing and our quote shareholders are happy, then that's basically what's going to happen. So it's not politics as much as it is, I would say, the financial partnerships between politicians, parties, and it's not just Republicans. I mean, there's plenty of Democrats, there's plenty of people on both sides that are, you know, perhaps in you know, partnership with lobbyists and so forth. So I don't see it so much as a political issue as I would say more of a financial issue. What's economically beneficial to corporations.
Very quickly, tie in with the Super Bowl, Philadelphia Eagles, of course, playing the Kansas City Chiefs today. And before every Eagle game, a bald eagle would fly out, which has given attention to bald eagles. Bald eagles almost disappeared due to DDT, the insecticide, several years ago. Yeah. So given the fact that it was outlawed, DDT was, it has helped the bald eagles. They've actually come back. They're not even on the endangered list any longer. And we have benefited because there's no DDT in the environment. So have many other species benefited by the bald eagle being there in the first place. And secondly, by no DDT affecting them either. We have very little time. My point is that given an opportunity, can species come back?
Absolutely. We saw this during COVID when there was a lockdown and people weren't going out. Within a matter of a couple of months, they saw an absolute measurable improvement in air quality and species coming back out and thriving again. So nature is very powerful and very resilient. And if given a chance, it will come back and it'll come back quick.
Arwinder Kaur, the author of Living While Human, A great read. Thank you very much. I'm sorry we're just out of time here, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.